This is Car Expert.
The Nissan feels a bit nicer, a bit more sophisticated, a bit more resolved, but the MG has a bit more bling and flash.
If you're parked in front of a wall, it will automatically put itself into reverse when you turn it on.
Really, in the last 18 months, 2 years, the diesel conversation in CX land has really disappeared.
Hello, my name's Mandy Turner. Joining me this week is Scott Colley.
G'day, Mandy.
And James Wong.
Hello, hello, everyone.
Now, this is really exciting for you guys, well, and Car Expert in general. Obviously, Car Expert was formed during COVID-19, so you guys have really not been together as part of a team, but now you are in a brand new office.
We are. We actually got very early days last year, about 2 weeks in the office before everyone went home for what we thought would just be a couple of weeks of work from home before the world returned to normal, and I think we were pretty right on that one. Everything was pretty standard last year. Nothing big happened. And yeah, here we are now. This is the first time we've actually been together as a team in Melbourne. And it is really, really exciting. Rather than having to ping Paul Marrick on Slack and then email and then phone call and then text and then carry a pigeon and then finally brick through his window and he doesn't respond to any of the others, you can just kick him under the table and get him to talk to you. And I actually get to sit next to James Wong again, although we're not looking at each other now because the microphones don't play nice when we're sat next to each other. So it's a real thrill. It's very exciting.
Yeah, it is actually really strange because I haven't been in an office for about a year, and the guys started at this office, as Scott said, for 2 weeks, but I wasn't really working with you guys yet. I was working with Ford. So like, this is just very weird being in like a communal space again and being within arm's reach of, like, you know, pinching people on the ear and poking them in the back. So it's actually quite fun.
And it means you can talk about cars too. It's a bit different when you're working from home and you've got this banter. If you find something online, a car for selling, you say, hey, look at this car, look over my shoulder.
And absolutely. I mean, having worked in the same office as us before, Mandy, you know full well that's most of what we do every day. So I also think like what we do, although we're not writing children's stories, is kind of creative because you're thinking of ideas and you're writing and you're trying to put things into context. And I know for me, like sitting around people and being able to bounce ideas off them and, you know, actually have some sort of collaboration on work live as it's happening rather than over instant message has been such a win in the past couple of days. I give it about 2 weeks before I'm sick of everyone and want to go home again. but for now, it's a really good step.
You're absolutely there 5 days a week?
I'm not quite sure. I think the plan is that we're going to be a little bit flexible. But, yeah, I don't want to give listeners and people who have a problem with us, you know, an opportunity to track us down on the way. So I don't want to give too much away about our movements. We don't travel together because we're like executives from a powerful oil company. Our plane can't go down. We always need a backup. So,
yeah. We're like the royal family, right? You can't have all the family in one go. Otherwise, if something happens to all of you, you need someone to carry on the bloodline.
None of this is serious. We just don't know, I think, at this stage. But with that said, Joe, if we were the royal family, who would you be?
I'd be the one that carries the bloodline.
And what car would you travel in? The more important question.
Oh, probably the Bentley Mulsanne, darling.
Of course.
The Queen's Mulsanne. She actually was selling that recently. I should have probably bought it.
Really? Yeah.
I can imagine that would have been an absolute bargain of a car. Very cheap, Bentley that was owned by the Queen.
Well, it's well priced for if it's fit for a queen, and it was wonderfully specced from memory. So I'll probably have to go check up the auctions.
It would have been armored too, wouldn't it? So it would have weighed even heavier than what it already is.
Well, yeah, and a Mulsanne's not really a lightweight, is it? It's already 3 tons from the factory, so I can imagine it was a very heavy thing.
Wow. All right, let's get stuck into this week's show. And to start off with this week's car news, actually we're going a little bit political. Scully, the new President Joe Biden has said he's going to make all the US government vehicle fleet electric. This is cool.
He has. So unless you've been living under a rock, you would know there was a federal election in the US very recently. And one of the things that Joe Biden has made a pretty big issue and campaigned on was environmental policy. And so he has committed to changing over about 640,000 cars, trucks and SUVs that are on the federal government fleet in the US at the moment and making them battery electric vehicles that are built in the USA. It's not yet clear how long that'll actually take. We don't know when the whole thing will be carried out, but Reuters estimates it could cost US $20 billion.
Wow.
Obviously, that's very expensive. But when you look at the numbers, according to the US General Services Administration, the US government fleet drove a combined 7.2 billion kilometers in 2019, and it consumed a combined 1.49 trillion liters of petrol and diesel. So provided the power for these electric vehicles is coming from somewhere renewable, you can think there's a huge environmental benefit to the US from actually from making this switch. Some of the vehicles that need replacing really are out of date as well. Vox reports that the current fleet of US Postal Service vans, it's approaching 30 years old and has no airbags, no anti-lock brakes, no aircon, and they use an average of 23 litres per 100 Ks. So these are changes that really are overdue in some places, and we don't know yet quite what it's going to look like in practice, because obviously there's a lot to play out, but on the surface, this is the sort of move that people have been calling for in Australia to really kickstart the EV industry. A bit of government leadership and a large fleet taking the opportunity to really invest in electric vehicles.
Would it also be worth noting that a lot of those cars that they're going to use on the government fleet will be American produced? So some of that cost will be offset by putting it back into the American economy?
It is, definitely. So one of the things that Biden has said is that he wants all of these vehicles to be American made. And he's also said that they're going to change the definition of US made, because at the moment there are some cars, supposedly, and this is according to the administration, that are built in the US that are classified as American made, but they're made of majority imported steel or imported parts. So the details of this are a little bit vaguer, and there is more following up that needs to be done going forward on how this is actually going to play out. But the goal does seem to be that American industry is the ones who are going to benefit most from this. And as with all politicians on either side of politics, there's going to be an element of grandstanding about this. And given we have very few details about how it will play out over the long run, there's a lot of water to go under the bridge before we can see whether it was a success or a failure. But certainly the way it's been pitched is a really proactive policy to try and encourage local manufacturing in the US and electric vehicle adoption.
All right, we're going to move on. Scully, the 2021 Tesla Model S and Model X has been revealed, and it's coming next year.
It sure is. So the big change to the Model S and the Model X is on the inside. The Model S has been around for quite a while now, but Tesla has given the exterior a mild update. You would definitely know what you're looking at when you see it, because it hasn't changed all that much. But inside, what it has done is take the 15-inch screen from the Model 3 and just make it bigger again. The screen in the new Model S and the Model X is a 17-inch horizontal unit. It's put a new screen in front of the driver, and it's given the driver a steering wheel that looks like it's come straight off a flight simulator. It's got the top chopped off, essentially. So it's sort of a yoke-style wheel, yoke with a Y, not joke with a J, just to be 100% clear. Although, yeah, God, I'm not sure about how you're going to use that in the real world, because it looks so different to anything we're used to. All the controls for the indicators, the wipers, the lights are on the steering wheel. They're touch-based controls. And then there's also new voice control that Tesla's put in place. I've been reading online about this, because obviously with Tesla, you don't just get a big dump of information like you do from most manufacturers. It just kind of trickles out and goes live online at different times. But from what we understand, the car will have certain things like if you're parked in front of a wall, for example, it will automatically put itself into reverse when you turn it on, so that you don't need to flick through the gears yourself, although there will be buttons for the gear shifter. So it seems like Tesla wants to take the minimalist approach and the real software-driven approach it's got at the moment and expand it even further with this interior. It's also put a new screen in the back between the front seats on the sort of what the transmission tunnel would be in a petrol car for the kids in the back. So there's some really interesting changes inside. I think the craziest thing with this car, though, as always, is the performance. The slowest Model S, and just to be 100% clear, this is the slowest one, will do 0 to 100 in 3.2 seconds.
Jesus.
The fastest one is called the Plaid Plus. It'll do 0 to 100 k's an hour in less than 2.1 seconds. Quoted power is more than 820 kilowatts. And it's got a claimed range of more than 840 kilometers, all of which are just wild numbers. So
just think about that. That's one, two. You're at 100 k's.
And then I'm lifting off the accelerator now, and my lungs are back where they should be now.
Well, who needs the Tesla Roadster anymore? They've pretty much got that powertrain in this, and it's almost pretty much as fast. So is that going to happen still?
Yeah, they've gone surprisingly quiet on the Roadster.
Yeah. Maybe you were right, Scott. Maybe it's not necessarily going to happen.
Yeah, let's not go down that rabbit hole. I am curious, guys. The Model S now is quite an old car. It's I want to say 8 years old off the top of my head.
Yeah,
how do you feel
like
about the way it looks? I know the new interior is pretty radical, but there is now some competition for it. Mercedes and BMW are going to have more competition for it this year. How do you feel it holds up in 2021?
I don't think it's dated all that much, though. What do you think, Jaywon?
I think that the design of the Model S is quite timeless, actually. It's a really elegant, like, attractive sedan. Like, the only thing I don't like about this update is that some of the wheel and overall body design makes the car look very generic. Like I was saying to Scott this morning while he was writing it, that it kind of looks like one of the background cars in a video game. it's a bit boring and weird and very like, you know, block color and like just very basic shapes. But I think that the overall like design and silhouette is actually quite timeless, and it still looks good now. I think what they really need to work on is, like, you know, Tesla's been riddled with build quality issues for so long. I think one of the big problems with the Model S is that it's so expensive, but you know, panel gaps as wide as your mouth when you've opened it sort of thing, and, you know, some other stuff that's been wrong with them. If they can get all that right, and now this interior's really come a long way forward, I think that this could be a real shot in the arm for Model S sales, because I know that with the Model 3, people have been like, oh, you know, it's got similar performance and range to the Model S, and it's got a newer design and everything, and it's a lot cheaper, whereas now it might actually give people a reason to shop up again.
Do we think people still care about the crazy acceleration figures? Because I know that they make for really good headlines, but I just wonder what relevance they have in the real world. I mean, I remember driving a Model S P100D with, I think it was ludicrous mode. If it wasn't, it was insane mode. And just, yeah, feeling like a physical assault. It was like being on a roller coaster, or I mean, to quote James May, it was like being in a football when it was kicked. I don't know that you need to go any faster than that, and I'm not sure that I necessarily want Tesla to be focusing its energy on going faster in the family sedan. I just feel like there's other things it could be working on that are going to be more beneficial for that car and cars going forward. But I might be alone in that. I'm not sure.
I think the only time you probably use it is, you know, gaining entry to a freeway, or just a bit of a party trick to show your friends how quick your car can go. So,
but even then, you're pretty much going to get in trouble and go to jail by the time you realize how fast you're going. Because even the base models are very fast. Like, Mandy, I'm sure you remember, there's a very famous video of me on social somewhere in the back of a Model X when we did the drag race at Sydney Motorsport Park, and I was very shocked and surprised quite audibly at how fast it was. So, and that wasn't even like the ludicrous one. So now that they're even faster again, like, I can't imagine, especially like a Model X, like, who's going to have their kids in the back and drive like that? Like, all your kids are going to be sick.
Exactly.
I mean, beyond even that, my mates, some of them really like cars, but I can't imagine they're going to sit in the new one and go, interesting, I can notice the extra 0.3 of a second that this is faster, and I really can discern the difference in acceleration as my eyeballs are being squeezed out the back of my head. Like, I wonder if maybe the focus should be better put elsewhere now.
Now, Jaywon, Rivian, a heap of money has just been put into more funding for this new electric vehicle car company.
Yeah, so Rivian, we've covered quite a bit over the last few years because it's another electric upstart, and they've just secured a huge amount of money in their next investment period for 2021. So US $2.65 billion, which converts to converts to about $3.43 billion Australian dollars. They're about to launch their first models. So the R1T pickup and R1S SUV were revealed a couple of years ago as early pre-production concepts or whatever, but the production models are going to stay fairly true to that, and they're going to start in the USA. I'm pretty sure they're built there too, right? This is an American company. So, like, they're building and delivering their first vehicles later this year. but they are only doing their launch edition models first, which are quite expensive, but have almost 500 kilometers of electric range. They're also going to be helping build 100,000 delivery vans. That's going to be for Amazon, the massive e-commerce giant. And
yeah, I wonder if the US government will pick up on this as well.
Yeah, well, it seems like it seems like there's going to be a lot of electrification going in the US over the next couple of years. If Biden's doing his first thing talking about the fleet, it has to be within the next 4 years, right? So it's going to be a very fast-tracked process. And, you know, there's going to be more companies like Rivian that are, you know, off the back of trailblazers like Tesla. So if they've got these two first models, depending on how much more money they can raise and how successful their sales go, we'll probably see them do more partnerships like this with other companies, like with these delivery vans, or they may continue to bring out more models. I'm not 100% familiar with all their stuff. So Scott, would you be able to jump in for me here and just tell us a little bit more about what their plans are?
So Rivian is one of we'll call it the OGs of the electric truck world. It's a really, really cool company. And anyone who's watched Long Way Up, which is the most recent Ewan McGregor and Charlie Borman motorbike special, it was on Apple TV, will know that the first two of the Utes, the R1T, that were produced actually were act as support cars for those guys. They went from the southern tip of Argentina all the way up through to LA. Because it was an all-electric trip and they held up really well. But essentially the R1T is like a rival to the Tesla Cybertruck and what will eventually become the electric Ford F-150. There are three different battery options available from 105 kilowatts to 180 kilowatts. And the company itself is a proper startup. It's been sort of founded in the US. They plan on building cars in the US and it's been engineered in the US. But they are also talking about bringing these cars to Australia, I think in 2023, potentially. A follow-up to that story beckons, so bear with me on that. I've now talked myself into actually sending the email and making the phone call tomorrow.
my bad. <yeah. laughs>
Essentially, it is meant to be slightly larger than a Ranger, but an all-electric Ford Ranger or Ford F-150 replacement. And Rivian has been developing this for quite a long time now. So, I mean, the proof is going to be in the driving, but on paper, it seems like a pretty convincing thing. I mean, 0 to 100 in less than 5 seconds and some pretty impressive range claims as well. Plus also, I mean, that 4.9-second claim is only for the base model. Apparently, you'll get to about 60 miles an hour in the most powerful car in 3 seconds, which is just crazy. Madness for a Ute. Yeah. You know, 820-kilo payload, 1-meter water fording, and a 5,000-kilo trailer towing rating. I mean, this thing really has the numbers to go head-to-head with the Utes we have at the moment and this new crop coming through like the Cybertruck, like the GM Hummer EV, and like what the F-150 EV will be as well.
Yeah, well, it just seems like everything about these cars is like big. Like they look big and imposing. The battery specs, they've got like a 180 kilowatt hour battery for the top model, which is massive. And the, you know, the power and torque figures, the performance claims are quite impressive given how big and heavy these cars are going to be. And the R1T and R1S are meant to have payloads of 800 kilograms and 820 kilograms respectively. And then they've got, you know, up to 5,000 kilograms of towing capacity, which is crazy. And that's something that I think previously one barrier for electric vehicles, particularly in the commercial segments, is being able to balance load lugging ability and, you know, all that sort of long range practicality with when it comes to, you know, heavy duty workload with battery technology and being able to provide range and performance while also being able to, you know, carry these heavy loads. So it seems like Rivian and Tesla, to be fair, with some of their upcoming commercial products, are sort of finding that happy medium where you can have a something that's so large and has so much capability, but also with an electric drivetrain that won't leave you, you know, stuck waiting for a charge point on the side of the highway because it doesn't have enough range. Mm. So it's quite impressive, these claims. So if they can, provided that they come to market and the real world performance matches that, that's really, really impressive.
Yeah, incredible. We're going to end with some very big news for Lotus, Scully. The Elise XZ and Evora are out, but they're being replaced.
They are out. See you later. So Lotus has had a lot of false dawns. There was the Danny Bahar era where there were five new models promised and then none of them actually came to light. There's been money from Proton and now money from Geely in the UK, obviously Chinese money, but they're investing in Lotus in the UK. And the upshot of all of that is that we now have an all-electric hypercar at the top of the Lotus range called the Evija. We're going to get a new car sitting between where the old Exige and the old Evora were called the Type 131, and then three new sports cars to replace the Elise, the Exige, and the Evora. They're all hidden under sheets in the photo on carexpert.com. But essentially, this is a brand new start for Lotus, and it's part of a big business plan the company has to go from about 1,600 cars a year to 5,000 vehicles in its current facilities, because that's all it can build, and then eventually build 10,000 cars a year by 2029. At the core of that is, yeah, replacing what is now a pretty aged model range, because the Elise actually was first revealed in 1995, and although it's been updated since then, it is still the same core concept, and it's a really appealing concept, obviously, if you like driving. But in 2021, with a bit more money behind the brand, it's really, you know, intriguing to see what Lotus will be able to do with this lightweight sports car idea. The Exige is now 21 years old as well. And again, it has been adapted over time, but it is still at its core that 20-year-old car. And the Evora is in an interesting part of the market where it goes head-to-head with the Porsche Cayman. And by all reports, it can drive, better than the Cayman on the limit. It really handles beautifully. But people buying a car for that sort of money want a little bit more than just a track car, and the Evora is still quite basic and doesn't have the build that the Porsche does inside. So it's going to be interesting to see where Lotus takes its model range under this new brand structure and this new model range, because, done right, it could really be the making of the company, but done poorly, and we've seen the trouble these old British sports car makers can find themselves in.
You did your good old brightening of the photos, Scully, on the site. Those three cars under the green blankets. You can actually see a little bit more once you up the brightness on them.
Yeah, it's always a trick. Sometimes car makers do it deliberately. But if they just make the photo dim, if you brighten the photo, often the car's revealed. More often than not, they actually put a black spot or something over it. And some car makers have been really clever with it and left little messages like good try or better luck next time, which is quite funny. But, yeah, brightening this one, you can see that they're quite sort of angular, the cars. They've all got very low, sharp noses and quite pronounced sharp fenders as well on the front of them. They also look compact, but obviously we don't know what the perspective of the photo actually is, so that's going to have to wait and see.
But we know they're not SUVs.
Which is a real relief, isn't it?
Yes.
I just hope this means that they're bringing the Esprit back, because they've been talking about that like my whole life.
Ooh, that's a thought.
Yeah. So, J-Wo, you are a British car sort of fan, given your love of green and tan things. How do you feel about the idea of a revived Lotus?
Well, I've now had, as you said before, they've had a few false dawns. So the whole revived Lotus thing has kind of come in waves over the last like 20 or so years. And, you know, growing up in the 90s, Lotus was a big part of, you know, video games and magazines and all that kind of stuff. It was huge on Top Gear. So like for me, Lotus is one of the brands that I've really followed as an automotive enthusiast from a very young age. And, you know, when I was growing up, the Esprit was sort of in its heyday and the Elise was new, the Exige was new. Then they started bringing out all these new products and they had some really cool stuff back in the day, and they've sort of lost their way. I feel like a lot of the British sports car makers, like TVR was another one. They had some really, really cool stuff through the 80s and 90s. And then once the big technology boom in automotive happened, they really tried to stay true to their, you know, pure driver focused roots. But, you know, there just comes a time where you sort of have to move on. And the fact that the Evija is a working prototype and they're, you know, they've got people buying them and it's on its way is great. But obviously a car like that at some ridiculous price, I can't remember what it was. It was like millions of dollars for this flagship. They need to have something that normal people might one day be able to attain. And I think if they can sort of stay true to the, or at least throw back to their history in terms of the design, the layout and everything, but bring all that modern tech that's sort of expected of cars today, I think would be a really cool thing. Because I think we've seen, even with like MG, for example, that is now Chinese owned and but still operates a lot out of the UK, they can still bring cool, attractive cars that still sort of hark back to their roots, but that play in today's rules. And so if they can manage to do that with these, I think there's no reason to not be excited about it.
Absolutely. Head to carexpert.com.au, click the news link if you want to read more on those stories. Well, if you're in the market for an EV, there's a lot of choice out there, and our job is to compare them and give you our thoughts on which is best, which is exactly what Mike Costello has done when he put the newcomer MG ZS EV up against the old favourite, the Nissan Leaf. Hello, Moko.
G'day, Mandy.
Why did you decide to put these two head-to-head?
Well, look, so the MG ZS EV has kind of made waves since it arrived because it's the cheapest electric car you can buy in the country, $43,990 drive away, and it comes in a fairly desirable SUV body style, so it ticks a lot of the boxes for those potential early adopters who want to get into the electrification race, but up until now haven't been able to afford it. Considering MG is a very fast-growing Chinese brand that really wants to kind of stake its claim as a mainstream player like Hyundai and Nissan and Mitsubishi and all the other mainstream brands, it's a really interesting vehicle. And then on the other side of the coin, I mean, the Nissan Leaf is sort of the old staple. It's into its second generation before many competitor brands have even rolled out their first. And alongside the Hyundai Ioniq is formerly, at least before the MG, the cheapest EV you can buy. So $49,990 before on-road costs for that, which equates to a drive-away price of about $53,000. So about $9,000 more than the MG, but still, by the standards of EVs, very affordable. Just to give you a bit of context, a Tesla Model 3 at very base level is about $72,000 drive-away, depending on what state you live in.
Okay. The ZS EV for me really isn't the first EV that would spring to mind. So should it be in the front of people's minds?
I think the price is really where this is going to succeed. So, you know, first of all, it's an SUV, and we know people want SUVs now, and the other two really affordable EVs out there, the Hyundai Ioniq and the Nissan Leaf. And when I say affordable, I mean affordable in context. Obviously, they're not $20,000 drive away, but they're both passenger car hatchbacks. And, you know, that's not a segment that's growing quite like small SUVs are. So I think from that perspective, it has a lot of legs. I think that price is aggressive enough to get people thinking about it. But I think from a branding perspective, it's also the vehicle that's going to introduce the reborn MG brand to the sort of people who probably didn't even know that it was around. You know, it's going to talk to a very different audience.
So let's talk range. Which car has the better range?
Oh, they're very, very similar. So they've both got relatively small capacity battery packs as befits their price. So it's a 40 kilowatt hour battery pack for the Leaf and a 44.5 kilowatt hour battery pack for the MG. The Leaf has a range of 270 Ks and the MG is just over 260 Ks, and they're both using the WLTP cycles, which are generally accepted to be fairly representative of the real world. So very, very, very close in terms of the amount of energy they use. My energy usage was about reflective of that. I mean, if you're in town and you're really leaning on the brake regeneration systems, you're probably going to get a slightly longer range. If it's really cold or if you're driving on highways, you're probably going to get a slightly shorter range, as these things tend to go. But very much billed as, you know, I guess city runabouts, urban runabouts, 270 Ks is nothing to sneeze at. I mean, I doubt many people would do a trip that long with a whole lot of regularity, but nevertheless, probably pitched more at your urban commuters.
Moko, Nissan has been in the EV game for quite a long time, and obviously there's more to driving a car than just numbers. In the real world, can you feel the difference between Nissan's more experienced sort of tuning in the Leaf and how the MG ZS drives?
I think this is one area where Nissan really does show its experience, as you allude to, Scully. It's got one feature called the E-pedal, which is really good. So basically, it's a brake regeneration system that you can engage. And when you lift off the throttle, you feel that extra sense of resistance as the motor is in reverse and capturing that otherwise wasted energy. And essentially, it means you can drive without touching the brakes 90% of the time. You learn to judge how quickly the car is going to slow down when you lift off the throttle. Once you've perfected the art, you barely use the brakes at all. The progression of the power delivery from that electric motor is super smooth. It's not at all, you know, obviously with any electric car, you get instant response and that instant hit of torque that makes them so punchy off the mark. But the Nissan has a real kind of smoothness and linearity to it. The brake pedal feel is fairly woeful, The driving position is not particularly well thought out, especially the lack of telescopic adjustment on the steering wheel. But in terms of smoothness and integration of the system, it is very good. Now, the MG has a similar brake regen system. In fact, the MGs has three different levels of resistance, and they even label it KERS, a bit like the F1 cars, kinetic energy recuperation system. But it's not quite as smooth or as well thought out as the Nissan's. It doesn't quite work as cohesively, in my view. And I think if you just want a car that you get in, don't even think about, and just bash around town in, that Leaf really does kind of take the lead.
Moko, you mentioned earlier how these two cars are, you know, the range is better suited to city driving and all that kind of stuff. Being two vehicles that are, you know, electric vehicles that are, you know, in the case of the ZS, it's based on quite a cheap SUV that's about half the price. Mm-hmm. What kind of, do you see the value in an early adopter going for one of these mainstream EVs and spending the 50 grand given, you know, there's fuel savings, emissions reductions and all that kind of stuff? Or do you still think that there's room to grow and that people should probably wait for the next generation of product?
Look, there's no doubt that you'll save a ton of money on fuel. I mean, you can work it out that, you know, if you get your off-peak tariff rates, it costs you sort of $5 or $6 to charge up a car. You know, so to drive 600 Ks is probably going to cost you between $10 and $12. It's going to cost you a hell of a lot more than that in a petrol or a diesel car, even with fuel prices being relatively low at the moment in the grand scheme. So you're going to save a ton of coin. But the reality with EVs like this is, no, they don't make any financial sense at this juncture. Most markets around the world where EVs have taken off, there are government subsidies or there are CO2 emissions caps that actually increase the price of ICE cars by comparison. Or there are all sorts of other levers that places around the world have used to try and incentivize the take-up of EVs. Right now in Australia, no, there really isn't a financial case to make for one of these, to be quite blunt about it. It really is a personal lifestyle decision. You want to be on the vanguard of change. You believe in the technology. And also the fact that EVs are just nice to drive. Anyone who's driven an EV knows that there's a real kind of relaxing serenity about them. They're so quiet. They obviously make zero noise except at very low speeds where they have to have it programmed in sort of chime. You know, the response is instantaneous. You don't have to rev them to actually get the most out of them. And once you adapt to that kind of vibe, it is quite hard to go back. But to get back to your core question, Wongy, no, you'll save money, but it's going to take you such a long time to pay off the additional cost. If you're purely looking at these cars from a cost-saving point of view, probably not going to stack up.
The other question that I think is worth asking is how fast can they charge? Because that's kind of the new battleground for these cars. Obviously, going quickly off the mark is one thing, but you don't want to be sitting on your hands all day waiting for the battery to fill up.
Yeah, so both of these, obviously, they're not the leading edge in sophistication. We're seeing cars now like the Porsche Taycan with, you know, its 800-volt electrical system using 350-kilowatt DC charges and, or, you know, the new Genesis product or the new Hyundai, what do they call it, the sub-brand, the Ioniq 5. And we're talking, you know, 80% charge in 20 minutes or whatever kind of figures they're throwing around. These cars don't do that. They're much more simple bits of machinery. So you're looking at about 7 to 7.5 hours on a wall box. Now, an AC wall box with 7-odd kilowatts or 6.6 kilowatts is the way most people will charge their EVs. You hardwire it into your house, it's in your garage, ready to roll. They can also take a DC charge of up to 50-odd kilowatts, and it's 45 minutes to 80% for the MG and 60 minutes via the Leaf. Now, the Leaf uses the older CHAdeMO type charge plug, whereas the MG has moved on to the new CCS type charge plug. And Nissan's signaled that it's going to move away from CHAdeMO onto CCS for the Ariya, its next iteration of EV. So the MG appears to be slightly quicker to charge. That was also my experience. But, you know, graded on a curve, they're very, very similar. And if you are the sort of person that just sort of does daily errands, you know, you do 20 or 30 Ks, you can even plug them into your regular 230-volt wall socket if you want to. It'll take 24 to 30 hours to charge up. But if you very rarely drive, you could probably get away with that too.
So, Moko, being urban-focused drivers, was there any, like, real differences in the way that these two perform, given one's a hatchback and one's a crossover?
Yeah, these are definitely sort of vehicles geared towards city slickers. Neither of them are particularly dynamic or agile in terms of handling. They've got quite soft loping rides. There's quite a lot of body lean and roll through corners. Neither of them love being driven in any sort of anger. And, you know, that's kind of, I guess, to be expected considering they are city vehicles. The Leaf is actually a bit longer and also a little bit heavier than the MG, but in my opinion is a bit nicer to drive. Its suspension is a bit less crashy over hits. That brake regen system that I mentioned earlier works a little better. It's got a little bit more punch. It's 3 tenths of a second faster to 100k an hour, so 7.9 seconds, which is pretty snappy. Both of these cars are super rapid to 60, and they do taper off just slightly, which you see with most sort of affordable EVs. The MG, you do have a slightly more commanding driving position, which is always nice, but the Nissan Leaf, you do set up fairly high as well. I think just punting around town is where both of these cars really are in their happy places. They do feel quite heavy for what they are. So, you know, mountain passes and things are not their natural habitat, but the quietude, the punch off the mark, and the relative softness of their rides makes them very ideal urban companions. I think, you know, to sort of, it's hard to quantify, but the Leaf just feels 10% more resolved in the way it goes about doing things, as I've sort of tried to capture in the words. And yeah, day to day, I think the Leaf is just that little bit nicer to get around in.
Moco, what about the interiors? Because the Leaf is functional but not particularly exciting. How does the MG stack up?
Yeah, well, neither of them are particularly high-end interiors. I mean, you can tell that both of these cars really do have a lot of cost savings found in them. We know that battery packs and electric motors are extraordinarily expensive, and so the only way to make EVs even vaguely affordable is to take a lot of other expensive bits out of them. The Leaf interior is quite nicely built. The material quality feels a little bit more sophisticated than the MG. The MG uses quite a lot of sort of brittle plastics, whereas the Leaf is a bit more solid. But the ergonomics aren't great. There's no telescopic adjustment on the wheel. There's a foot-operated park brake, which feels very old hat. There's a fairly dated infotainment system. There's a nice digitized trip computer in the instrument cluster, which gives you a lot of your electric car data, which is really handy. But getting in the Leaf, there's not a whole lot that screams out high-tech EV. It's quite practical. It's quite spacious. It's got the bigger boot on test, the bigger back seats on test, and it's perfectly inoffensive. But there's not a whole lot about it that's super exciting, perhaps except for the really interesting kind of circular little knob that you change gears with, which is not the same as your typical gear stick. The MG is very similar to the regular petrol MG ZS interior. There's nothing in the infotainment that at all is linked up to the electric car system, so there's no, you can't do any of the tweaks or changes or monitor what the EV system is up to through the center touchscreen. The material quality is not quite as sophisticated as the Nissan, as I said before, but it is better equipped. You know, it's got stuff like a full panoramic roof, which the Nissan doesn't get. So you do get more features and more tech for your money. It's also got a bit more of the active safety stuff than the Nissan does. So the Nissan feels a bit nicer, a bit more sophisticated, a bit, I guess, more resolved. But the MG has a bit more bling and flash. And if you're willing to put up with the slightly cheaper material qualities, probably offers more.
Okay. And lastly, Moco, servicing costs and warranty, how do they both compare?
Yeah, not as cheap as you'd think, to be honest with you. Both of them have fairly good intervals, so they're 20,000K or annual intervals, and the average servicing cost is about $300 a pop. So there's not a lot in it. They're very, very similar to own and run, but they're also not a whole lot cheaper to own and run than a regular petrol car. And we all thought that EVs would be super cheap to maintain because there's bugger all to them. They're so simple compared to combustion engines. But at least at the moment, probably because car brands make so much money servicing vehicles, they're not taking the opportunity to cut the prices. Both also have 8-year battery warranties, so you're allowed a certain amount of degradation, but once the degradation goes beyond an accepted limit, usually about 20% inside the 8 years, you can get a warranty claim on the battery as well.
Okay. All right. That comparison is up at carexpert.com.au, and the Nissan Leaf just nudged ahead, Moco.
Did just nudge ahead. So essentially the way I finished the story was to go, all things being equal, on the basis of its moderately more premium feeling cabin, its smoother energy recuperation system, its slightly better urban ride quality, and its superior boot space, I'd take the Leaf. But it's not a $9,000 superior vehicle to the MG either. The MG feels very, very close. If, you know, money and, you know, budget is your absolute priority, the MG does offer more for less. It's just that the Leaf feels a smidgen more resolved. But I think it's a pretty good result for MG. This is a brand, it was the first time we've put one of their cars in a comparison test at Car Expert. It's the first time We've tested sort of a vehicle this sophisticated from a Chinese brand, and for it to take it right up to one of the more established players, I think was a pretty sound effort.
Yeah. Mike Costello, thank you very much.
Much obliged, guys. Thank you.
Now, Joe, you sat down with Mazda recently. What did you actually speak about?
Yes, so I recently attended the launch for the updated Mazda MX-5 and CX-9 ranges. All the content is slowly going live to Car Expert, so you'll see some news stories and some reviews here and there. But what I've done here is that I've spoken to Vinesh Bindi, who is the Managing Director for Mazda Australia, as well as Alistair Doak, who's the Product and Marketing Director. I asked them a few questions about some of the other model lines that we didn't cover in terms of driving at the launch, and so I got some really interesting insights into where Mazda is at today.
The Mazda CX-30 will properly kickstart Mazda's foray into electrification by having a full electric version and also the mild hybrid. I know you've got the SkyActiv-X with that technology already. Are there any other areas in the Australian market that Mazda would like to venture into with electrification, given the success, for example, of the Toyota RAV4 hybrid?
So when you look at the electrification side of things, you could say, you know, we've got it in the Mazda 6 when we launched it with IE Loop, so there was a level of electrification. We've got SkyActiv X that has got electrification, and then MX-30 will be the full EV, mm-hmm. and with Mazda 3 and CX-30 SkyActiv X. Electrification technology will accelerate, not just for us, but for all brands globally. The issue that I see in Australia is potentially the issue around generation of renewable energy and the infrastructure to support consumers to move in that direction. And I think that's what's going to hold Australia back. But it's not going to do it forever. At some point, I think the government of the day will have to consider electrification. But as long as they invest in renewable energy and affordable renewable energy, I think we will see more and more electrification coming. All brands are preparing for this for Europe. Once Biden gets in what, a couple of days, I think there will be some change, or most people expect there's some change likely to happen there, which means car companies will have the technology and infrastructure to bring electrification to their products. And as soon as that happens, and if our customers here in Australia desire it, want it, we will be able to offer that. But I think it'll just take a little bit longer.
Right. And off the back of that, are there plans to expand like the M hybrid branding, or like will there be some sort of like branding, sub-branding for like MX-30 being the EV, or is there plans to sort of widen that portfolio as well in the same vein? So like, you know how you've got like SkyActiv-X M hybrid and you've got MX-30 M hybrid, will that sort of be a thing that you might push later on as well?
In terms of separate branding, probably not, because in the end it's under the Mazda umbrella. And Mazda offers various technologies that is available, including, you know, hopefully eventually we can launch the rotary range extender. So we don't have a plan to have a separate branding exercise, but of course in our communications we will promote the technology that we have.
Sort of on the topic of CX-9, having a two-pronged attack on the large SUV segment, there's a couple of brands doing it, including Mazda. Do you find that has that been a successful strategy for Mazda? Like, has there been any cannibalization? Do you find that there's any issues with people perhaps maybe wanting a diesel engine in a CX-9, but they can't get it?
Oh, we always have those, so maybe.
Yeah, not as much as you would think, actually. I think those questions happened when we first introduced CX-8 into the range, but I think, you know, people, you know, do their research online and then they know what's available, and then they may test drive both, and it comes down to size mostly rather than anything else. But no, we really in the last 18 months, 2 years, the kind of diesel conversation in CX-9 has really disappeared, mm-hmm. I think. So, and to answer the original question, CX-8, CX-9 together has been fantastic. I mean, really, it's done incredibly well for us. So I think if you look at the market share for private buyer with those two models combined, I think we're number one in this thing, aren't we? I think something like that. We're certainly up there. So it's done really well. It's good. They've complemented each other, and that was the original plan. And it's always nice when a plan works, basically.
Do you find that there's demand for the 2.5 turbo in the CX-8 like there is in Japan?
Not so much. I mean, it's available to us if we wanted it, but we haven't done that because we don't see the demand there. Obviously, we were keen to add the 2.5 naturally aspirated engine, which we've done, and that's what's driven, you know, the increase in CX-8 sales and record number last month, which is great. So yeah, we always knew it's a younger family who will buy CX-8, so they tend to have less income. So they're a little bit more value driven, I guess. So that makes sense. Rather than pushing too far up, you know, you've got CX-9 to cover that part of the market. Really, it's you wanted to, you know, richen the kind of offering at the more sport touring kind of level.
So do you find that CX-8, the sales mix is richer at the lower end as opposed to the higher end, where it's the other way around for the CX-9?
It's still a very strong mix because it's touring is probably the most popular one in CX-8. So from a mix point of view, it's still good. And I think others would be envious of the mix. But yes, it doesn't stretch up as high as the CX-9.
But on the point of cannibalization, I think in the industry, some brands talk about that a lot when they make product decisions. But you remember, as I said in there, our strategy is we've got to give choice. And when you have that strategy, we don't worry about cannibalization, because in the end, if they pick one Mazda product over the other, it's great. We're giving the customer an option, and we're satisfying their desire, their need. So cannibalization is not a conversation we really worry about compared to some others where they have to have certain level of minimum sales to be able to convince the factory to be able to engineer it, design it, and put it in the program. Mm-hmm. We are lucky in that sense that our strategy and our factory's ability are aligned. Being nimble, smaller on a global scale, and we prefer to give choice.
Mm-hmm. On the topic of like two-pronged attacks and choice, you've got CX-30 between CX-3 and CX-5 and plugging that gap that was there a while ago. Does that, with the next generation of products, is that gap between at the lower end and the higher end going to widen? Like, will CX-3 sort of cover more of the lower end, or will it sort of close the gap from underneath, and will CX-5 sort of move up? Is that, you able to sort of touch on that at all at this point?
Yeah, it's a bit early to talk about the future products, but as products come out, there's always going to be a timing issue where a product has moved in a particular direction because either that market or that customer chooses to have something different at the time. But eventually, it then rolls out into the other products if that trend and demand is required. So our plan is whatever options are available in that future CX-5 and above in the large platform, as we say, Mazda Corporation has confirmed that inline-six will be an option, rear-wheel drive. So those things are going to be available to us. Where it fits in, we just have to see when the final product is signed off and we're able to launch. But our plan is we cannot have huge gaps in our offering.
Right. That kind of led into the question I had about that large architecture. You've sort of touched on it already, but do you have an idea of whether that will sort of, because that's that layout, that engine and drivetrain layout is very in line with like the premium brands. Is that I asked earlier about the going up further in the market. Is that sort of strategy sort of going to be rolled out across more and more of those lineups? Because you look at like medium segment now, and a lot of the mainstream brands are bleeding into the premium territory by going, you know, high-end models are sort of $50,000 to $60,000. Is that something that you're seeing success in and will continue doing moving forward?
Yeah, look, it is our plan to offer products that are classified as premium or seen as premium, but the value equations still need to exist. We see it as, in Australia, there's a clear luxury territory where the pricing reflects that luxury territory, but that's not where we are going to be. We are more about offering options, but pushing towards the premium. Now, the premium part of it has got a few dimensions to it. Having safety as standard, having the technology in there, but we also about having the driving experience and the human-centric philosophy in design, and it's all about the driver. That part still exists in Mazda engineers, sort of at the core. So whatever they bring out, and I would say that the technologies that we have confirmed, which is the inline six rear-wheel drive, is all about that human-centric driving experience element of car ownership.
I've got a couple more. On the topic of human-centric, you've got cars like the MX-5, which is it's a dying breed when you look at globally with emission standards and things like that. A lot of competitors are either dying out or they're being forced into turbocharging and electrification. How far into the future do you see MX-5 being viable as a sports car model, not just in Australia, but like globally?
Global.
Look, as long as we can, basically.
Some of this is influenced by governments in each countries and the regulations they get. You know, you hear things like, you know, internal combustion engine will not be allowed, but we don't know where each country will end. In Australia, I think MX-5, even in small numbers, still makes sense. It's a niche offering. That sort of offering MX-30 will offer as well. As long as it's available, Mazda Corporation is producing it, we'll have it. So I think there's still some time. And you've got to also understand that there is technology still evolving to support cars, and I think sports cars will be around. They're not going to disappear anytime soon, except some countries may choose to have regulations that doesn't allow it to be sold in their markets. I can't see that happening in Australia anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, let's hope so. And then finally, in the light car segment, there's an increasing amount of manufacturers that are pulling out, citing, you know, costs and slowing sales, because that segment's sort of been declining of late. How committed is Mazda to the two and the light car segment in general? Because that's a pretty been a long-running thing for Mazda in Australia.
Yeah, absolutely. We're committed to it, and obviously, we you know, when we launched the current model and the update, you know, we put the price up, and everybody went, "Oh, you know, what's going on?" Mazda priced themselves out of the market. Well, a number of times last year, we actually had to phone up the factory and say, "Can we have some more?" Because the thing is doing better than we expected. So no, we are absolutely committed to the car. It's doing well. It's an important segment, obviously. You know, first car for many people. There's also a niche there of kind of last car for some people as well, and that's the role that Mazda 2's played for us for a long time, and CX-3 also picks up some of that territory now as well. So now absolutely we're staying and we're there and enjoying success with it, which is nice.
Yeah, great. All right, well, I think that's it for me, so thank you very much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to welcome now the most passionate car man at Car Expert. Hello, Tony Crawford.
Hello. Look, I wouldn't say I'm the most passionate. I think everyone on this call, including yourself, Mandy, is is the ultimate passion
this is
car
the
enthusiast.
Way you talk, the way you yeah. talk about cars, Crawford.
We wouldn't be doing this, right,
passion.
If we didn't love cars, surely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is why I love talking to OEMs, because they're our friends, because these guys join those companies because they love cars, right? They must.
Exactly, yes. Ooh, yeah. We'd like to think so, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. I never thought I'd see you in a Skoda Scala, but you were, this week, last week? How did you find it?
This week? Yeah, I think this week. I didn't think I'd be in a Scala car that was basically up against its Golf cousin. That's for sure. I mean, I got used to them with SUVs and Octavias and Superbs and everything else that they do, but this was a gap they needed to fill. And they filled it pretty well. I mean, I've only spent 3 days in the car, so it's not like I've driven the car forever. But I'm sure it's not going to suit some people, the styling, because I would have to say the Golf 7.5, and of course we've got the 8 coming in Q2 of this year, which will look even more resolved. But I would say the Golf, you know, it's had 7.5 now, 8 generations to evolve into pretty much the perfect 5-door hatch daily. I think not many people would disagree with that sentiment. But it's been around since 19 in Europe. It had some issues with not so much a technical fault. Well, it was a technical fault, something to do with a light warning coming on. Scully and Jay will probably know more about that, why the delay of stop sale was happening, and then it got released, and we all got to drive it this week. And it's a really simple model lineup. In fact, well, it's one model with 3 variants: the 110 TSI, which is their entry level, and then there's the Monte Carlo, which is a slightly sportier setup with a lowered suspension, 15 mil lower. Haven't driven any of them but the Launch Edition, which is the range topper of that model range. And it's roughly 35 grand drive away. And I got to tell you, with the amount of kit that this car gets in its base trim, it's quite staggering. I mean, automatic tailgate. You know, like who would ever figure that in a bog standard hatch, you know, for basically 26, 27 grand drive away. This is a car that's going to impress a lot of people because of the kit. But, you know, at the end of the day, that's what Skoda does. They package something up into a slightly quirky styling exercise, and then they basically have it for a little bit below the Volkswagen equivalent, but they put more kit into it and more sensible kit. I mean, I was pleasantly surprised to see the driver's door has the hidden umbrella. And in a rainy day in Sydney, which it has been raining all week, that this is a good thing. And, you know, this Launch Edition, 35 grand drive away, that's going to be a lot – well, that's already a lot cheaper. That's 2 or 3 grand cheaper than the equivalent Golf at the moment, 7.5 gen, Mark 7.5 gen Golf. And, of course, I think the Generation 8 is going to be even more expensive, but that, again, is probably going to have a lot more kit and a lot more high-tech stuff than its 7.5 stablemate. But, look, this really impressed me. I'll tell you what I liked about this car. I liked the fact that it had Alcantara/leather seats, and they were good Golf style buckets, if you like, that really held you in place. Super comfortable, great driving position. The steering, I just sat there for a minute and looked at this steering wheel and thought, this is a really good steering wheel. Perforated leather, molded grips, just the right circumference. And I just thought, you know, there's just the level of detail in that steering wheel alone. And it's not an overly embossed steering wheel with a whole bunch of buttons on it. It's a really simple approach the way they've designed this, and I really like that. It's got a really big 9.2-inch infotainment display, and the touchscreen works really well. It's really quick to respond to the touch. Then it's got a virtual cockpit, which I think is around 10.25-inch virtual cockpit that has 5 different display modes. I know that because I went through them all, and I settled on the one with the big taco in the middle and the big speed, because I need to know what speed I'm doing. I've got to be careful with speed these days, which is why that big screen helps. And it handles really well. I wouldn't say it's as resolved as the equivalent Golf in terms of its handling. There's a little bit of body roll, but that doesn't seem to affect the actual – you can have a bit of fun in this car. It's not fast by any means because it's 110 kilowatts and 250 newton meters from a 1. Now, this is the interesting bit. It's a 1.5 turbo 4, whereas the 7.5 Golf runs a 1.4. And I was a bit surprised by that, and I'm thinking, oh, here we go. Skoda may be getting a sort of an older engine, if you like, that's not used on many Volkswagen product. But in actual fact, when I spoke to the guys at Skoda, they said it's an evolution of the 1.4. So it's a more modern version, a more sophisticated version than the 1.4. So that was kind of good to know. And it goes pretty well, like for pretty standard run-of-the-mill Golf specs these days. I was surprised at how peppy it is. It's not fast, but it's certainly gets up and goes when you, and it certainly won't be left behind in the traffic or on the freeway for that matter. The ride is good. The ride is notoriously good with Skoda and Volkswagen product, being owned by the same group or in the same group. And so that was good. It was running on Goodyear Eagle tyres, so really quality rubber. This is where it beats Golf. It has a 467-litre boot capacity. Golf has 380. This is a substantial increase on the Golf. And rear seat legroom behind where I sit was excellent. That's the only word I could use, excellent. A lot of room. Headroom, I think, Scully and anyone over 5'10 might struggle in the rear, that is, because it has quite a nice tapered roof line down the back and it has some really cool features on the outside. I'm digressing everywhere, but I'm kind of excited by this car in many ways because it has so much to attract a buyer with.
So, Crawf,
yeah,
the Scala is built on the same platform as the Volkswagen Polo instead of the Golf, even though it is a bigger car.
Longer and taller.
Does it feel like a small car that's been stretched when you're out on the highway, or does it have that kind of relaxed, comfortable, solid feeling that a Golf and the bigger Volkswagen products have?
Yeah, that would be the latter. Certainly comfortable, does not feel stretched. It's a very easy car to drive. Vision out the back is not amazing, but of course you've got cameras and you've got front and rear parking sensors on this edition. I would say it feels, you'd need to drive a Golf back-to-back with this car to really, it'd be a fantastic review for Moco to do a comparison with its equivalent stablemate. I'd do it with the launch edition. Although, I'd love to drive the Monte Carlo. It's a stiffer suspension and a lowered suspension. So where this car has a little bit of body roll, if you get a little bit enthusiastic through some roundabouts, string a few roundabouts together, there is body roll, and I'm assuming the Monte Carlo with its differently tuned suspension would resolve that. Not that that needs resolving for many people. I mean, I doubt many people would even notice the body roll through corners, but, that's at quite a decent clip too. So this will do, I think it's, just forgotten the 0-100 on this.
8.3 seconds, Crawl.
8.3. Yeah, it feels it actually feels a bit quicker than that. I wouldn't have thought it was that slow when you really give it to it and put it into sport. So it's got various drive modes, normal, sport, snow, which you get on a lot of Skodas, and you can access those by the touch screen, which is good, or you can roll that proper shift lever, I might add, proper shift lever down one into sport. It's also got a normal handbrake, leather wrapped. It's got a ton of features. Adaptive cruise control, heated front and rear seats in this one, 4 USB-C ports. Yeah, Apple CarPlay, Android Auto, you name it. It's got a wireless charging. Basically anything you could name on a way more expensive vehicle is in this launch edition Scala for 35 drive away.
What would you have, the Scala or the Golf?
I kept asking myself that, and really I think Skoda buyers are more pragmatic people that are looking for, you know, bigger bang for buck, and that's what this gives, certainly. It's probably, as I said, $2,000 cheaper than its equivalent Golf, but packs more in and has a bigger boot space. So, I mean, you know, really you'd be, I don't know, kind of mad to buy a Golf unless you really like the styling and or you went for the more, you know, sportier lines like JWO with his GTI or further up the R, which Skoda obviously doesn't offer in there because this being their first attempt at a small car in the small car segment. So, look, I'm expecting it to sell pretty well. I really am. They've got some cool styling things, like the Skoda lettering on the back is on this sort of really blacked out section of the actual rear screen. And I think that looks really good. And then when you open it up, it's got, you know, I've got five nets in the boot. So I can pretty much lock down everything. And even, you know, your bicycle helmets are in the back behind the actual rear seat. Now, the seats fold 60-40. There isn't a center armrest, which I, you know, in this premium edition, I thought there would be, but there isn't. But there is two USB-C ports and there is air conditioning vents. And again, it's got that Alcantara and leather upholstery in the rear seats as well. I'm blown away by the bang for buck, the price, the fact that it rides pretty well. I don't think it rides quite as well as the Golf, the last Golf that I drove, which wasn't a GTI. So there might be some, you know, it does have a rear torsion beam axle. So does Golf have that, JWO?
No, the Golf has independent rear suspension on
I think you can feel that. I think you can feel a slightly not as mature suspension setup in this. But really, at the end of the day, it is a comfortable ride that absorbs the bumps and the broken road as good as many other small cars, if not better.
All right. That sounds like a bit of a wrap there, Croft. Okay. The Skoda Scala, you can head to Car Expert and do some searching and reading and watching on that car. Yeah. Thank you so much, Croft.
Thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate it.
That's an end to this week's podcast. What car events coming up next week, Scully?
It is a busy couple of weeks coming up. I think coming out of the Australia Day public holiday long weekend, there's a whole lot of stuff happening, and we're also well and truly into the swing of the year now. People are back at school and work is back and life is kind of normal. So Croft is driving the Hyundai Kona, our Skoda Scala correspondent, going Korean. And Kurt up in Sydney is also driving the Skoda Kamiq 110 TSI Monte Carlo. Very interested to hear what he thinks of that because Croft was a big fan of the regular car. The Monte Carlo promises to be a bit sportier. Next week, I'll be driving the new Audi Q5, both the petrol and the diesel. So very curious to see what's changed there. And James, I know this will have already happened by the time the podcast goes live, but you're doing a charity drive on the weekend.
Yeah, so Paul and I are going to be joining Drive Against Depression. We've done a lot of drives with them over the last few years, and it's the first time that they've been able to hold an event probably since about this time last year. So I'm very excited to be joining, and I'm sure Paul is as well. But unfortunately, by the time this podcast goes live, it'll have already been done. But definitely make sure that you stay tuned to the Drive Against Depression website for any upcoming events. And, you know, if you come along, you'll probably get to meet a few of us on the team and see some of the cars that we've got through the garage. So definitely look out for those now that we're allowed to have people gathering after lockdown.
What cars are in the garage for next week, Scully?
At the moment, we have got a really interesting spread. Everything from the cheapest Toyota Yaris money can buy with a manual transmission and a bright snot green exterior through to a Ranger FX4 Max. We've got a 2.2-litre diesel base Hyundai Santa Fe that JWO is reviewing. I'm driving a bright orange Kia Stinger complete with personalised number plates that also say Stinger. My housemate pulled in behind me last night and he said, "Why'd they need to say it twice?" And then Moco is driving the new Toyota Fortuner Crusade. So there's a really interesting spread of stuff through the garage.
Awesome. As always, we're always keen to hear from you, podcast@carexpert.com.au. And if you haven't given us a rating, if you're a new listener, please do so. Scott Colley and James Wong, been a pleasure.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.